on today's episode of the Uplifter Podcast.
When music, you know, when you can go across the country or the world and someone fucks with your music, and that's like, that's a wild thing. Like, still to this day, I'm not like jaded to be like in awe of that shit. That like, it was made for fun. It was made in this room. It wasn't made with in a giant fucking studio with $1 million. It was made like me sort of fumbling my way through fucking whatever technology I had at the time.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the all-new Uplifter Podcast presented by The Band Aeration. My name is Drake Peterson. If you are a first-time listener, let me explain how this show works. Each episode is hosted by one of the members of The Band Aeration, and they're going to be bringing on one of their friends. Today, Micah Pouchel is hosting alongside myself, and he is going to be bringing on one of my favorite artists, Cisco Adler. Thanks for listening, and enjoy The Uplifter. Now joining us is songwriter, singer, Grammy-nominated producer, and the founder of the brand new live stream platform that is making waves called No Cap. Please welcome the legendary Cisco Adler.
How you doing, guys?
How are you doing?
Golf clap.
Golf clap. Macro clap.
Full macro clap.
Which sounds bad, but is actually great.
What's up, boys? Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for being on with us. This is like a whole new kind of setup that we're doing as far as the Uplifter. We're making it less, not the whole band and one person. So it's a little bit more intimate. We can get a little bit more in depth. We can have a little bit more real conversation as opposed to like, you know, six people trying to talk on it. Yeah. Trying to talk to each other at the same time.
Cool. So let's get intimate, guys.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do is kind of delve in a little bit on your whole background and this kind of move chronologically if we can, and then probably go through your musical, you know, career and then go through into where you are now and No Cap and all that stuff and, you know, just do it like that and keep it loose.
Fuck, cool. 20 years, I guess it's 20 years now. Fucking old man time has caught up to me.
Oh, same. I mean, look at my beard.
We're experts, but that just means we're old.
Exactly. But we're, you know, I think it's getting old is a privilege, right? You know, that's what they say. And
I appreciate the experience. I appreciate the mistakes made over the years, even in the sense of the music business. And you look back and none of them are mistakes, right?
Yeah, everything happens for a reason, I suppose.
Yeah.
So where were you born? Let's just start at the very beginning. Like,
fuck. I was born at Cedar Sinai.
Yep.
In okay. Beverly Hills, California.
Yeah. We know a few people that were born in Cedar Sinai.
Yeah. It was a cloudy day and the sun came out.
Love it. Sounds about right. So I think just to clarify, your father is Lou Adler.
I was born to a music man and a model, which it's crazy that they got together. I've never heard of that.
Right. That never happens.
Yeah, but you know, my pops. It's funny because it wasn't like music just was the norm. He was just going to the studio, and that's where I spent some of my time playing around as a kid. But I think as I found my way into the industry and was never really, he never put an instrument in my hand. He never was like, you have to do this. So it's even just more a testament to like, it was in my blood. It's just what I'm supposed to do. And I found my way to it on my own.
Yeah. And for people that are listening that may not know, like, you know, Lou Adler worked with Carole King, Mamas and the Papas, did the Monterey Pop Festival, Rocky Horror Picture Show, stuff like that. Cheech and Chong, just a legend. And he's also the guy that everybody knows that sits next to Jack Nicholson at Lakers games, right? So everybody, you know, he's become in his, you know, later stages of his life, like that's the guy that everybody knows him as now, you know, that are the younger audience that aren't necessarily, you know, the Carole King Mamas and Papas fans. But So you know, growing up in a musical household, like, do you have early memories? Like, you're saying you have memories of going to the studio. Were those memories that in particular, like, are there anything that really stood out to you about it, or did it feel different, or did it feel pretty normal when you're growing up?
No, super normal. It was all I knew. You know, my parents split up, I think before I was conscious. So I was like 6 months old. So I've never really seen them in the same room, but I mean, I've seen them in the same room, but not if they had to be.
It wasn't pleasant.
Yeah. But I definitely have this like duality, you know, my mom is sort of, she split to Maui when I was 9. So I grew up there with her, super salt of the earth, like, you know, grew up running around in banana fields. And then the flip side would be, I would come to see my dad and I would sort of be in this other world, which to me, both, it was a super normal upbringing. Even the duality was just how it was. I think when you're a kid, you don't really base your life off of any other person's experiences, right? But I definitely spent a lot of time going to shows. You know, now looking back, knowing that like I was at like Hall & Oates shows when I was like 2, and like hung out with Jimmy Buffett. And I've known his daughter since we were born. And like, those things are, I like was like, holy fuck. One day I was like, damn, like,
yeah,
that's awesome. It's exactly how I would want, to be brought up. So I'm super lucky, but yeah, it was super normal.
What are your memories of growing up in Maui? I mean, besides, you know, you say running through banana fields, like what part of Maui, first of all? 'Cause you know, my family's from Maui. My dad is from Maui. So
yeah, I grew up in Kihei mostly. I went to Kihei school.
Yep.
And Maui was like, it was, I guess, had a big impact on me now looking back. When you're a kid, you kind of just go with the flow. My mom was like, grab your shit, grab the skateboard, we're moving to Hawaii, right? And I was like, okay, you know? And I think now I'm so thankful that she took me there and I grew up on the island, away from this city, away from Hollywood. And obviously I had connections to it and I came in and out of it, but it didn't define me. I think Hawaii defines me more as a person.
Interesting. And you were there until you went to high school there, right? You went to Seabury and
I went to Seabury. I graduated there. And then I split after that. I went to college at University of Arizona. I don't know if there's any, I don't know if on the books, I don't know if there's any like actual evidence that I was there or in the school, but I went there for a spell and then left in the middle of the night. 'Cause I was, making beats in my apartment there and was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. What am I doing in the middle of the desert when I can be in LA and working with artists?
So what was your major for the brief time that you were there, just to get a
raging
macro rage?
Yeah, full macro rage. I don't even know if I had a major. I don't think I got. I like took piano at Pima Community College, and like, I don't think I went to class more than like 10 times in 2 years.
Cool. Well, you made it. You were there for 2 years though. So that's longer than a spell, I'd say.
Yeah. I was there for 2 years. It was dope. 'Cause we won the championship that my second year.
The basketball, right?
Bibby, Jason Terry, all those dudes were my homies. Like it was a fun time to be there. And like, I knew I wasn't going to college to get a degree or to specialize in a trade. I was going to college to experience college so that when I went and chased my dream, I would never look back and say I didn't have the college experience. You know, it seems like I was maybe just sort of wandering, but it was actually, as I look back subconsciously, it was very focused. And I was like, I need to check certain boxes because I know I'm not going to do the normal thing. And I want to be able to not look back and be like, oh, I missed that because I was doing this.
Right. You probably have a lot of people in your life telling you, like, you don't want to miss the college experience and it's the best time of your life. And, you know, you went to school, you went to good school, you got education.
I had some good times after that.
Yeah, so same. So you say you're making beats. So it was like the first musical thing that you were creating. Was that music? Was it like hip hop, or was it a mixture of kind of what you started doing later, or was it kind of a build into that?
I started freestyle rapping like in Hawaii in the back of the car smoking weed with my boys, right?
Same. That's, everybody does it, I think.
Yeah, like
in Hawaii, yeah.
And then at one point I was like, fuck, if I could make beats, I'm hearing beats in my head. I need to figure out how to make beats, and then I can complete this sort of thing, because I felt like I had a talent for that. And so when I got to I think I was making beats earlier than that, but really in college is when I started acquiring equipment and like taking the money I should probably be spending on books and buying a keyboard or buying a little sampler and stuff like that. And then I started producing some people, some rappers around there, and really just, it was a steady progression until Eminem came out, and I was like, there isn't really a need for another one. Like, he did it. He did everything that I was sort of seeing, and that's maybe when I changed my course a little bit and was like, okay, I'm going to focus on producing the music, and, you know, rapping sort of took a backseat to that, but informed me with my beats and definitely, you know, allowed me to get in the room with rappers and contribute to the lyricism. And like, I had studied rap music so deeply to where, like, you know, I feel like every decision I was making in the studio was hugely informed by like a long time education in hip hop music, you know. And through hip hop music, I discovered samples, and the samples led me to the original record. And I started sort of like, you know, it was weird. It was the seed to the tree that, and I think hip hop is special because it's such a amalgamation of so many types of music that through one genre, I discovered many genres.
Yeah, especially through samples, you know what I mean? You know, you look at Dr. Dre and he's sampling so much of that 70s funk and stuff like that. So I was going to say, for me, I remember in high school and being a ninth grader in high school, and one of the only guys that was like a real hardcore hip hop guy in my school was a guy older than me. His name was Ty Park. Shout out Ty Parks, if you're out there.
Shout out.
He was a heavy duty skateboarder, way into the skateboard scene. I was not a skater, but we had a shared love of like hip hop, because I remember watching MTV as a kid and coming upon Cream by Wu-Tang Clan and EPMD, and these artists where it, like, I really was like, whoa, like this is, like Cream especially, I was way in on it. And so I mentioned to him that I liked that, and he was like, what, you like Wu-Tang Clan? And this is, you know, and so he told me, like, I remember this distinctly, he said, yo, you got to check this out, there's this guy about to come out, his name's Eminem, and it's the Slim Shady EP, you got to check it out, it's going to be like crazy, before it came out. And so I was like, when it came out, I saw My Name Is, you know, came out, and I didn't really like it. And he's like, trust me, just get the album. It's not going to be like that. Like,
dude, like, I never meant to give you mushrooms, girl, all those. So it's funny. That shit. So I had this weird connection to L.A., obviously. So I had all these like friends in L.A. And I would come to L.A. for the summer, and then I'd go back to Hawaii. And it was like I came back from the future. Right. Because in Hawaii at that time, like, movies took 2 or 3 years to get to us. Yeah. Right. And music definitely took a long time. But all the kids here had the Eminem demo because someone's daughter or son had taken the demo. You know, I mean, Zoe Winkler, who I know is the girl on the beginning of that album, who's like, oh, ew, really? This fucking da 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 da. Like, we knew that girl, right? And so that, it's funny because I think that, like, thinking back, the success of that whole thing was based on that album leaking and circulating. Whereas like that happens online now, but it still happened before. It was just like, it was on tape.
Yeah. And I think that was a big part of hip hop culture is the leaking of the album like months in advance. I remember in college, Tunji Balogun, who's like a big time A&R in the Hell business yeah. now, like big, big guy. He was the one that would leak all the albums to me and my roommate. And like, he was an huge Eminem fan. Like, he knew every lyric to every Eminem song ever. And so we shared that love of Eminem in college. And then he would leak, like, I remember he leaked the Blueprint 2, Kanye, College Dropout, like, all the, and a Late Registration, all those albums, we had them, like months and months and months before they came out. And it was, like, a huge part of it was, like, that culture.
Well, the kids, the cool kids, had to get the records first for anyone else to fuck with it. And that's still true to this day. And, like, most of the leaks we know about, they aren't even leaks. They were, like, they were given. They were they were on purposely given to the right channels. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Have you been leaked anything recently that we should be
putting
on our radar? Yeah, anything that you've received?
That's interesting. That's a good question. I'm horrible with those type of questions. But I will say that, you know, my own career, the early Schwayze stuff, we gave out to everyone, like, for a year. That whole album that came out later was already out. The kids had already had it, were already spreading it. And, like, that is never to the detriment of the sales. I think everyone realized early in hip hop. And it's one of the reasons why maybe rock music took a back seat to hip hop.
Because they were still waiting till the release date to.
Yeah, they had long album cycles. They were waiting to the release date. And it's like, by the time the release date is kind of the end.
Yeah, it's like that's the beginning of the end, essentially, of the
album. Yeah, you're just like, okay, it's out. Okay, ha.
The life, and now it's even faster, right? Because, like, the life cycle of an album is like a month now.
Totally. But listen, we got Dominic Fike shit like early around here. It was floating around. I think, like, all that early Odd Future shit. You know, this kid, what's his name?
A lot of the LA stuff.
Yeah.
Odd Future.
Yeah, that shit's, the LA stuff, like, hits the LA culture before it hits anything. You know what I mean?
So what were your biggest, as far as hip hop goes, like, what would you say were the influences that really shaped your kind of?
As far as hip hop goes, it was like De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, Ghetto Boys, NWA on the sort of gangster side, like Far Side. I think the Far Side was like massively ahead of anything.
So that more hip hop tip.
Yeah, and once I heard rap with a melody, I was hooked on a whole different level. You know what I mean? Because I'm like I like catchy hooks. I like I have no shame in liking a catchy hook. Like I like a hook that I can sing or that someone else can sing, and so when I started hearing that shit, it really blew my mind. Nas, Hero. The Illadelph Half-Life from The Roots, like, blew my fucking mind. But even stuff like Freestyle Fellowship, Another Level, Dell, like, the sort of obscure shit.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of more cerebral hip-hop lyricism, stuff that was on another level, that was more talking about consciousness. And you know, it obviously, I was pretty big on the gangster stuff too, but it's like, you know, that stuff was definitely more in spin with my friend group. You know what I mean? Like the people that I was hanging around with.
Yeah, the gangster stuff too. If you like, a lot of the gangster stuff was heavy on the great samples,
right?
Right, and it was sampling a lot of that early soul and funk and like Dre. You're talking about like, so I think maybe it was the music, but there was definitely a time where we all thought we were little gangsters.
Of course. It came at the.
It's a funny time to think about, like, because we were not.
Right. No, we were like 13, and I was like 13 to through, you know, 18. I think when that was like really hitting its stride. I remember like in middle school wanting to get Doggy Style by Snoop Dogg, and like having to get the tape, the CD, and my mom, like, I had to like sneak it because it had the parental explicit lyric thing on the front.
That's what rock and roll was like for our parents, right? So, like, it was kind of our counterculture music to, like, that was, like, dangerous, and which is really, like, draws the kids to. But then when I heard, like, it's funny, because in my carpool, these two dudes would play, like, Black Sabbath and, like, tons of heavy shit. And like, I hated it at first, but it soaked in. And like, I was forced to listen to it every day.
Yeah.
And I think it really informed me on the sort of rock side of things subconsciously now looking back. And then when I discovered like the Rolling Stones and like stuff like that, it was game over for me, as it completed everything for me.
So let's transition. I think you, like, was White Star the first like project that you did as an artist?
Yeah, White Star was like, originally I rapped and this other guy sang, Asher, and it started because I was making beats and I discovered like the Rolling Stones, and I was like, oh damn, I gotta sample this. And I started sampling like Zeppelin and Bowie and like the Stones, and that was the first White Star sort of demo. Was like huge samples we could never clear, and it was sort of this perfect mix of like hip hop and guitars, and sort of where it was the music I had always like wanted to hear but never knew it.
Yeah, yeah. As when you said Rolling Stones, that was like the first thing that to me felt like what White Star was like Stones, Zeppelin, and like Guns N' Roses plus.
Well,
like,
we went that way as it evolved. It like I started, you know, we formed a band and we started heading in that direction, which was like this like quote unquote classic rock thing. Which, you know, it's funny because White Star, I always say it was the biggest band that never made it. Like we were like, I mean, if you would have asked us, we might have thought we were fucking doing arenas. You know what I mean? But like, and we had like fans, like the girls were crazy. If you were in LA, you went to a White Star show to like get laid, basically, I think is what it was. And we did some crazy tours. We toured with like ZZ Top and Kid Rock and stuff like that. But at one point I had an epiphany that like I was doing something that had already been done. And that was the day I was like, nah. And I, on the side, I was doing the Swayze stuff because Aaron was sleeping on my couch. And I was making like the Mickey Avalon stuff. And like, as a producer, I was finding ways to use that hip hop bag of tools. And when we started making the Swayze stuff, I was just like, you know what? This is going to be in 20 years what kids say they grew up on. And White Star is not going to be. White Star is going to just be almost a cover band that wasn't a cover band.
Interesting.
And I remember that fucking moment. I was in a kitchen and I was like, this is it. I have to go. I have to change my course.
Today's episode is brought to you by irationmusic.com. It's time to get your holiday shopping finished right here, right now. And guess what, guys? There's a secret sale going on at irationmusic.com where you can get 20% off. That's right, 20% off from shirts to light up LED hats all the way to stocking stuffers, jackets, accessories, and swag. Use the code ALOHA2020 for 20% off at checkout. Again, that is ALOHA2020 at irationmusic.com for 20% off for all of your holiday shopping needs. Special thank you to everyone that came out to the drive-in shows this past weekend. We had a super fun time playing for the first time in what seemed like a year. The sold-out San Diego show on Saturday was live streamed at nocapshows.com, and if you didn't have a chance to check it out, you can still go and watch it. Just go to nocapshows.com for the full live show today. We play almost all of the new songs off the new album Coastin', as well as some other fan favorites. Lastly, there's a new song out featuring Iration, and it is fire. Bear Grylls is a DJ and EDM artist, and he featured Iration as well as some other amazing artists like our friends Catastro on his new album, The Friends Album. Go check it out on all streaming platforms. The song Iration is on is called Give Them What They Want. It's a bopper, y'all. So find it by searching Bear Grylls, that's B-E-A-R space Grylls, G-R-I-L-L-Z, on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you stream your music.
So what was the process of, because I'll tell you something funny, was when we all lived, the band all lived in a house together. We all lived in a house in Santa Barbara together after college. Like, we all were sharing rooms together. Like, Jody and King lived in a bunk bed. Like, we were all in one house. It was gnarly for a while. Like, And we would sit down on our TV and we'd DVR The Rock Life. And we would watch the show. Yeah, we would watch anything that was like a documentary about music.
Yeah.
Like, and we would watch it all the time. And we kind of, I think, I don't know if we had met you or knew, at some point had met you at somewhere through Mike or something. Or
we were passing at that point, right? I remember when you guys started, for sure.
And or maybe we knew somebody that knew you or something like that. But we watched it and we were like, I just remember watching it and like, we just thought it was like awesome. Because we were like, this is like the tour life, you know what I mean? And we had yet to go on tour when that first.
That's amazing.
So we went on our first tour in 08. I think the show came out in like right around that time. And we were like.
That show was like 06.
Yeah, yeah. So we were like just starting to kind of come together and get ready to go on. We're playing gigs and stuff, but we were not, had not done like a national tour. So we were watching you like playing these shows in LA and like the scene being crazy. And we were all just like, you know, holy shit, like this is awesome. Beardo, like.
Now I could probably just watch that show and actually laugh. Like the wounds have healed enough that it was like, cause it was, the funny thing is like we did the Buzzin' show on MTV after that.
Right.
And I had sort of taken that experience of making the Rock Life show and made sure that when we did the Buzzin' show, it was only about the music. It was not about like the things that the Rock Life was about. Right.
Right.
And I think because of it, it was able to be a vehicle for the music, whereas the Rock Life was a vehicle for the personalities. You know what I mean? And so I was very clear that like, this has to follow us on our path to like trying to achieve goals and focus on the music at large. And if I would had never done the Rock Life, I wouldn't have been able to do the Buzzin' show, right? I was like, we're not doing that again.
A lot of drunken hijinks from what I remember.
And it was like the producers were like, ah, they said this about you. Like, did you know you should go like pick a fight with them?
Oh yeah, you're egging you on. Yeah, it was like a precursor. I mean, it was like a precursor to like.
Dude, I mean, I got to say, we fucking pioneered some shit. It was early days. It was when like people were like a reality show, like, oh my God, right?
Yeah.
And now we have like, and we have the Kardashians who like, it obviously worked.
Yes, it works. Yeah, 100%. So transitioning from White Star, you kind of figured out like, this is what I want to do. Aaron's living on your couch. You're making beats already anyway. And then, so how does the Shwayze project kind of kick off? And like, what was the first kind of few songs that you had and how did that kind of take off?
We did maybe three or four songs and like the fifth song was Buzzin'. Like it was early. And like, it was funny cause it was catching on, right? But the minute we made that song, it's the first time I realized what a song can do, right? And like, that was it. We gave that song to someone, it was fucking gone. They gave it to everyone. They gave it to like everyone on earth. So I made that shit right here in this room.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like still to this day, there's some magic in this room that like, you know, that was going on.
So did you, when you made it, did you have that feeling of like, I mean, did you know like, oh, this is going to be a hit? Or was it kind of like,
no. I don't think we can ever choose that as the creator. Right. And right. If we think we can put our finger on it, we're probably delusional because the fans choose what's the hit. Right. But that it was quickly evident that was like lightning in a bottle. And it's funny because I went to a meeting with Jordan Schur, who became our manager, and he wanted to hear the White Star stuff, and I was like, I gotta play you this other song. And I played him Buzzin', and he was like, that's it, deal's on the table, what do you want, that's a smash. Like it was like that.
He knew, he heard it because he was
obviously like a weird Hollywood cliche. He's like, yeah, like that's a smash, we want, like we're gonna take that around the world, you know.
Maybe it's not a, I mean, it's a cliche for a reason then. Maybe you, I mean, you hear it, you hear that story, but it's like, you know, you're here to testify that it's true. Like it does happen that way sometimes. Yeah.
And he had an ear. He has an ear. I mean, obviously we know that he sold fucking hundreds of millions of albums. And then from that point, we were just sort of going. The good thing about that project is he, and I give him like sort of a shout out to this, It wasn't like we got signed and then the label came in and tried to make us something different. It was like we looked at all the body of work we already had and we picked from that. And even though the songs were already out, like I said, as far as like being given out, we that whole album was already stuff that that we made on our own with no influence from the label, with nothing like that. The only one that wasn't was Corona and Lime, because Will.i.am heard Buzzin' and he was like, I need a Buzzin'. I need a Buzzin'. I need you to go in the studio and make a Buzzin' for me. And I was like, okay. And I made Corona and Lime and he didn't want it. He didn't fuck with it.
Really?
Yeah. And Shway was pissed. Shway was like, "That I want that one. That's the one. We need that right now."
Yeah.
And like, I was like, nah, I got to give it to Will. And Will didn't want it. So then we cut it. And like, that was a bigger hit than Buzzin' on the charts, yeah. Right? But it's funny because that one was like a very purposeful. That was like, okay, I figured out the formula. I made that song in like 12 minutes. It was like, bing, 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 bing. Okay, here.
Did you ever hear back from Will after you released it?
I see Will all the time, but no. And actually, Will did a remix for Buzzin' for us that he jumped on. No, but like, thank fucking God he didn't want that shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
it happened for a reason. Like, then again, you know, like
it was like, and it's funny because when you make a song, and I know this as like a songwriter or producer, when you make a song for someone else, you have way less of the hangups of writing a song for yourself, right? And like, you're not putting all these implications on it. And so I was able to just like freeform, just make a song quickly. Oh, this is what's good about our shit. Oh, hook, bang, 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 bang. Like, you know, but yeah, it's funny that I tell that story all the time because it's like, thank you, Will, for rejecting that one.
Yeah, he's got enough. He's got enough hits as it is. You know what I mean? Like, what is?
Yeah, it was good for him too.
So after the Swayze thing, you kind of got that going, and in the midst of the Swayze thing, then you start. When do you start working with like Mickey Avalon and? And that
Mickey was before. Mickey opened up for White Star, and I saw him, and I was like, "That is where I can use my toolkit." I was like, "There's something there, right?" So I started working with Yesh, maybe 2006, way before Shway. Like Shway came into the fold after, and I was sort of like, I took what worked with the Mickey Avalon stuff and applied it to this other thing, right? I always sort of take pieces of what works and put it onto the next one. But that was funny too. She came over and I had the Jane Fonda beat and I was like, I got an idea. I want to make a song called Jane Fonda. And like, and he was like, are you crazy? He's like, fuck you. Who do you think I am? He almost left.
Really?
Yeah, he was like, that's not me. Like, da, 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 da. And I was like, just fucking trust me. I see it. Just trust me. I know there's something about, like, using that pop culture reference of a name. And like, it that one fucking, that one went. Well, that was my first hit. That was my first song that played on the radio. That was my first shit where, like, I walked into a club in New York and they were playing it and I was like, whoa, okay.
We like those songs, those Mickey Avalon songs spun in the Iration crew heavily. Like obviously that was in a time when we were partying a lot. So it was like the jams that you're putting on and like getting pumped to go out or like, you know, you getting your psych on. So like, yeah, for a long time. Yeah.
When music, you know, when you can go across the country or the world and someone fucks with your music, and that's like, that's a wild thing. Like still to this day, I'm not like jaded to be like in awe of that shit. That like, it was made for fun. It was made in this room. It wasn't made in a giant fucking studio with $1 million. It was made like me sort of fumbling my way through fucking whatever technology I had at the time.
It hit this like kind of interesting like vein in the culture at the time too. It was this like kind of, it felt like almost like a rebirth of like the kind of grungy LA, like chic, like that kind of dirty, chic-y, druggy kind of thing that hit like in that time frame. And it like, it just struck with people like hard. You know what I mean? I think that's what it was. Like
that scene was wild, right? And like, you can't really shock anyone anymore.
Yeah.
But that shit was shocking.
Yeah.
You know? And then the Dirt Nasty shit. Like, that was just a whole moment. That was a moment.
Which is hilarious. You know, it was just like, it was like the thing that would made the Dirt Nasty stuff was like, it was Simon Rex doing like the funniest, say, like being just hilarious. He's still hilarious, but like, but the beats and like the music was fire. So it was like this crazy.
We were just dropping zingers after zingers.
And then when you put them together, it was like, even like you had the mishmash of like, we understand that it's, we're not taking ourselves like too seriously. You know, it's really about fun and like this kind of motif of like, we're out here to have like a good time, party it up. Like, but you know, Mickey had this like a little bit more like credibility from as far as like, I'm a musician.
He really was on the street. He really did like do some shit that he said he did. His shit was slightly autobiographical. And you know, Dirt, Simon found him and got him to start rapping.
Oh, really?
Simon's like a genius A&R. Simon found Riff Raff. Simon is like a brilliant human. You know what I mean? And like one of the funniest people I know on the planet Earth still to this day.
Dude, he's so funny.
You know, but he, it's funny because he knew Yesh and those guys and was like, you got to start rapping. Like, there's something here, you know?
So, you know, you're going through that whole phase. You're getting, you know, you're dating some of these, like, you know, big wig, you know, socialites, I should say. And you're getting a lot of paparazzi.
Too. I fucking pioneered that shit.
Did you really? The paparazzi thing?
No, I mean, so, dude, it was just that's who was out there. Like, you know what I mean? It was like, that's the dating pool.
That was the pool that you're hanging with. It was that crew. And then, so what, I mean, just to, we don't have to go deep into this, but like, what is it? Is it, was it that time of your life getting followed by paparazzi and like that feeling? Is that something that you like were okay with at the time because you're young? Was it annoying? Was it, you know, ridiculous?
It was fun at first. It's intoxicating, you know, right? And like, but it's also really weird, super weird. Like, they used to, like, be in my bushes. Jordan Schur also said to me one day, there's, like, these defining moments in my life that I just, like, remember so distinctly. And he was like, I don't care if you stop fucking them, but stop being seen with them. He's like, you're never going to be known for your music, and you're too talented. And people just know you as the dude who's banging all these chicks, right? And, like, I was like, whoa, like, that's an interesting perspective. And so I really just shifted my course to putting my head down, getting out of that. I didn't stop hanging out and doing and having fun, but I definitely stopped being, like, known for that. Because, you know, I was known for dating someone. I wasn't known for being a talented musician who was dating someone.
Yeah, and that's definitely a trap that, I mean, it feels like that happens a lot, you know, in Hollywood, where you get attached to somebody and then whatever it is you do gets minimized because you're just attached to somebody that's at that moment is really famous or is really on, you know, in the lexicon or whatever.
I was like, fuck, that's not what I'm put on earth for.
Some people would think like the opposite. They'd be like, oh, if I want to be famous, I need to get with this crew and, you know, be seen by the paparazzi, but didn't really work that way, huh?
You need to.
I think that's what you do if you don't have talent.
I do think that, like, at that time, it was so early in the, like, being famous for being famous thing, right? It was the dawn of the internet. It was the dawn of, like, the gossip blogs. It was the dawn of that shit. So I think it was early days for people to be able to separate or you couldn't capitalize on it the way you can now, right? You couldn't just drop a fucking a line or some shit.
There was no like, they didn't know how to monetize it exactly. It was just like, okay, I'm just being famous. It wasn't like, oh, I'm gonna hop on Instagram now and make money off like selling a product or something, you know?
How weird is that? That there was none of that shit. Like, we're the last generation that has lived on both sides of this thing. Like, we know what life was like before. Like, dog, if there was social media when we were doing what we were doing, psht, I mean, are you crazy?
No, I know. I think everybody has that, like, thought, like, oh, my God, if when I was in high school, that's our age at least, like, when I was in high school, if we had social media, like, my life would be different right now. You know what I mean? Like, or I would.
I did. We did use MySpace. Like Shway and I blew up off MySpace. We were definitely a band that blew up off MySpace, which was using new technology for the as a tool. And you have to do that. And that's why when people say TikTok's a bad word and all this stuff, you're just putting yourself in a position to not use the tool that's now being offered, right? And so I always try to look at these things and tell, now I tell my artists, I don't have to do so much of that for myself, but I tell my artists, like, don't think of it as a bad word. Dive into it, figure out the science of it, and figure it out, because you could break on that shit. Like,
yeah.
You know, technology has enabled us to for our music. We don't, you had to go on tour and go fan by fan back in the day. It was the only way. And you had to get on the radio. Those were the gatekeepers. Now it's been democratized. You can just upload your shit to fucking Spotify. You can fucking go viral. You can do that. Like, that's pretty awesome that's sort of happened for music right now. It also makes a lot of garbage fucking make it. And like, so
there's a lot of stuff to sift through before you get to the quality now.
The what's next is probably the sifting through that and the dust settling.
Right, right. So you do, you kind of get Shwayzy, you know, you kind of go, you do the Shwayzy thing for a while. And then, you know, what was the decision? You kind of transferred into this like singer songwriter kind of vibe, you know what I mean? Where it's just you and acoustic guitar, you're kind of doing a different, little bit of a different feel, you know, it felt like introspective stuff.
Yeah. I think life, like I've never been one to like squeeze all the water out of the rock. I like to jump to the next chapter apparently I did it with the White Star stuff. And like, I was like, now it's time to move. Like I have to I have to turn the pages or I get bored of my own fucking story. I can't read the same page over and over again. And I think it just sort of like, you know, wanted to maybe tell a different story, a different side of the story than people were maybe getting.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. I mean, I understand like, yeah, you, like what we referenced earlier, you kind of get pigeonholed into this. You can get pigeonholed into a specific box, you know, especially in the world of popular music and culture and stuff like that.
But I was just singing the hook, right?
Right
too.
Right.
Like, yeah. So I'd make the beat, put the hook down and stop. Yeah. And like, yeah. After a while that gets boring.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to be more, you want to do more, you have more in you to put out.
You know, and it's funny, like at this point I don't do it for any other reason than my soul. Like I don't really care who's listening sort of thing. You know what I mean? But it's funny because it finds its own fans. And like, you know, I've been able to have a solo career because of Spotify and because without touring anymore. So I kind of just like compartmentalized my life. And then I had a kid and I didn't want to tour anymore once I have a kid, which you now have a kid. Luckily, you get to spend these first couple years. COVID's probably a blessing for you because you would have been on tour while your little baby was, you know, those moments, right?
Totally.
And I was done. Totally. I was like, I'm not missing that shit. Like, I'm staying home. I think I was on, no, I wasn't on tour with you guys. I was on tour with Modest Yahoo. And I just like, was like, I'm done. I just walked off the bus, got a ticket, flew home. I was like, I'm done. That's it. Chapter done.
I think you got married like.
Oh like, my God. Yes.
Right after our tour or like during our tour or something like that. Or right before it.
Yeah, right before. Yeah, that was a fucking wild transition time. Like coming to terms with getting married in that chapter after being like, I was always like, damn, like I'm John McEnroe. I can't put the racket down. But like, thank God I put the racket down and like my girl like saw something in me that I didn't even know existed, right? I trusted her at that point.
That's awesome. And I mean, obviously kids change, they just do change you and there's really nothing you can do.
It's the best. It's acid.
Of course. Yeah. It's different. It's a different headspace that you get into. I mean, part of that is probably just like sleep deprecation for like a long time, but it like, you know, it gets into your DNA.
You're never going to sleep again.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm not. You were right. You're right.
Like, I got a dude who's like this big who comes into my bed and kicks me all night.
You got a dude now. You got another dude living at your house.
Yeah, he like farts in my face and laughs at me.
And then asks for money.
Yeah, that's and that the dollar amount just goes up the older he gets.
But it's awesome. Like, life is so fucking fun. And we're so blessed. We get to make music and it's made a career. Like, the fact that we bang on shit and sing fucking words and, like, we're so, like, very lucky that that's what we do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of what this whole COVID thing has been is, like, how lucky we are to do what we do, you know? As musicians, it's, like, it is kind of silly when you think about it in those terms. Like, that's our job. Like, you know, there's people that are, like, you know, treating COVID patients and, like, you know, coming up with vaccines or coming up with, like, cures for diseases, and we're like getting on stage and singing words that we wrote on our couch.
To some of them, what we do is super important, and like it really changes their whole outlook of their day or their life, and to soundtrack someone's life is like an honor.
And I think we understand that, because before you're a musician, you're a fan. You're always a fan, and like the artists that we're fans of, you know, we think about what they meant to us, and it's like they were larger than life. They changed your life. You held them on a pedestal. You put them on a throne. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know,
it's why I'll always take a picture. I'll always sit there and chat with a fan. Cause if like, that's my duty, if that's all I got to do and there it's going to make their day better or whatever, like that is 100% my obligation.
Totally. So now speaking of that interaction, we've transitioned into, you know, this no cap thing. So this streaming service that, you know, we've been working together on for these last few streams that Iration has done. And, you know, this was something that was kind of, I guess it was a brainchild of like yourself and, who's it, Donovan as well, Frankenrider, and some other cats. And, maybe we want to just kind of break down where that came about. And
you know, I can trace the whole thread of my fucking life. It's so weird. And I wonder if like, I can't wait till I'm like 105 and I'm what else gets added to that thread that I can trace back. But like, I started, when I left college, I came here, I started promoting nights, clubs, right? Then when I started White Star, I just took that same list and invited them to the first show. And so like, and then the White Star thing, I transitioned into the Shwayze thing. The Shwayze thing into the this, that. So everything's like this, like, I see the thread going through. But this was so natural to me, being that I grew up, you know, with a venue in the family. I know how venues work. I know how having a venue that lasts for 40 plus years is not easy. Small venues, bands grow out of small venues, right? It's like a crazy thing.
The Roxy was arguably one of the venues that, you know, grew Iration. You know what I mean? Like that was the first, you know, I just remember as when we were coming up, we were playing, you know, these smaller gigs in LA and stuff. And then when we got our first gig at the Roxy, we're like, oh shit, like we're going to play on Sunset Strip. We're going to play at the Roxy. And like selling out at the Roxy was like a huge moment for us in our career. Like Adam still talks, like he still talks about it. And like whenever we do interviews, he's like, sold out Roxy. You know, like those are like our career conference.
It's a rite of passage, right?
Totally.
But looking at, you know, the first days of this pandemic, literally the first days, I was like, okay, what's going to happen here? I see the landscape ahead. And Donovan actually called me and he was like, yo, you're the only person I think who will understand this. He's like, I got to figure out what the future of this situation is for me as an artist who tours 300. Donovan does like 300 fucking plus days a year. He's like a fucking beast. And he's like, I'm not going to do the couch show for fucking Martin Guitars. And then at the minute I'm done with it, I'm like, why the fuck did I just do that? Right? Like, I'm giving myself too much. He's like, I would need to figure out how to monetize this. Right? And I was like, okay, that's interesting. But like, I feel like that's OnlyFans, and like that's like there's already those things that exist. If you really want to access them, you could do it. I'm like, why don't we think about it from a different perspective, which is like there's all these venues that are dark, that have crews that are not working, that have infrastructure, sound, lighting, and there's a network of them across the world. To me, how do we look at it holistically? What is the music business going to do right now? Not what is Donovan going to do right now? And to me, it was like, I remember when streaming music came about, and I remember the lights went out in half of the buildings, right? And everyone was like, the industry's over. It's done. The music industry is fucking done. And I was like, no, it seems like the music industry is just starting, right? It seems like access is going to be democratized, and this is really a great thing for the music industry, streaming, right? And we know that the ones that ran away from it, and the ones that ran right at the sun are thriving, right? And we have our new stars of streaming music. We have Spotify stars, right? To me, this was the same moment, but for live music, which has not been disrupted since the 50s, right? The live music model has been exactly the same. Like, yeah, the promoter promotes the show, you go, you sell 500 tickets till you sell out the Roxy, then you have to jump to the Wiltern, then you have to jump to the Hollywood Bowl, and like that's the only way to do this. And so I was like, this is a defining moment. Let's figure out how to jump on that disruption, not look at it like, how do we capitalize on COVID? How do we take this moment of disruption and change the model going forward for the history of live music to change? And to me, digital, it's just everything's going digital in the entire world, right? Like, so what is the way to do that? Live stream concerts have been talked about for a couple years now, but they never caught on because the audience never had any reason to try it, right? And now they're forced to try it. And if you would have ever told anyone that you're going to be watching this new movie from your bed on Netflix, you would have been like, nah, I like to go to movie theaters, right? And like, we know how that went. So this is just the same thing. And I don't think it's taking away from the model that exists. We all know some form of live music is going to come back. I don't think it's going to be the same. I don't think climate change is going to make it so that you can go out and travel the way that we've all traveled. It's going to change, right? Not only that, great. If you live in New York City or LA or Nashville, you're going to see a bunch of shows. If you live in fucking Timbuktu, you're never seeing your favorite act play, right?
Yeah.
And so how do we bring the shows to those people? If you live in the small markets in Germany that aren't Berlin and Hamburg, you're not going to go see your favorite band. And if you live in Hamburg, you're probably going to see your favorite American band once every 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and you're a slave to whatever venues in your town. You know, even if you are in a small market town and we do come, you're slave. You're seeing us in a venue that, you know, a lot of times is less than desirable place to see a show. It's not set up properly for a show, or you're getting like a weird sound, or the viewing experience just isn't great, you know?
Well, how do we bring the show to the world? How do we make it not so that everyone who went to see shows before starts watching online? How do we bring shows to the 10, 20, 30X people who couldn't see shows before, right? And that's one of the things when I talk to bands about doing this, some bands inherently get up there and they're like, this is weird as fuck. I can't wait to see you again when everything gets back to normal. When really your fans aren't feeling that way. They're like, I'm seeing a show. I fuck with you. I'm hyped to see you. I don't care if it's through my screen. Same way as I watch a movie, right? If a movie came on Netflix and it was like, we know this isn't as good as the theater, so we're going to give you the... It's like when you play like, you have 3 banger sold out shows, then you roll into a town and it's like half full and you're like, fuck this shit. And you give them like a shitty show, right? And you play shitty because you play down to the crowd. When they're like, I paid the same amount as the people at the sold out show, and I don't care that it's half full. And in fact, I kind of love that I get to see it this way, right? As a fan. Yeah. So I just think we're on the dawn, or we're seeing the dawn of a new medium that is going to change your reach, maybe it makes it so bands don't have to go out 300 days a year, and maybe it makes those shows they do play more special. Maybe it, in fact, gets their guarantees up because they don't just do the same fucking rotation. You know, you're a summer band. It's like me. Yeah. Like, my streams go up as soon as the weather gets good. I'm sure yours does, too.
Same, yeah.
And right now, I can look at them. They're starting to go down because we're getting to the fucking winter. Yes. Right?
Yes. Yep.
And it's like fucking hilarious. It's summer in Australia. Like, it's summer somewhere.
Yep.
So turn on the fucking show and play. And the fact that we can sell merch to people who aren't going to be able to go to a show and buy that t-shirt and they can still feel like they got a fucking piece of it. I just think, like, new shit feels weird, but it's not necessarily weird to the person watching it, you know? So I just got excited, and now, like, I haven't even made music in fucking 6 months because I wake up every day and I'm just like hungry to fucking build this company and expand the sort of footprint of No Cap, book more bands. Tomorrow we announce a Foo Fighters show, which will arguably be one of the biggest live streams in the industry, right? They did Saturday Night Live a couple nights ago. Now they're doing No Cap. Right? So a band of that stature to realize that this medium is fucking real and to certify it and say, we're launching an album, we're launching a single, and we need to do a live stream, it's game over. I don't think you can ever drop an album without doing a live stream anymore, because you got to reach your global audience.
And especially a band that is so synonymous with live, performing live, like the Foo Fighters. Like, that's what their whole thing is about, is like, we show up, we rock for 3 hours, and we
and they're so awesome. They're like, we don't need crazy production. We don't need nothing. We're just going to fucking plug in at the Roxy, and we're going to fucking play some rock and roll, and that's what our people want to see, right? And I guarantee you Dave Grohl is going to be fucking sick about how he approaches it on stage, right? Because he's going to see the future of it and be like, my fans are through here. They're through this screen, right? I have to play to them. And they're everywhere. I also think, like, this is going to open up markets you didn't know you had. And you're going to see the analytics. And you're going to be like, whoa, I'm fucking massive in Portugal. Like, I'm going to Portugal and play an arena. Right? And, like, Spotify does that for people. I know there's people, smart managers have identified markets that they've never gone to. And they're like, whoa, there's an uptick in, like, Chattanooga, not Nashville. Right?
Yeah.
And so we got to go to Chattanooga. And, like, there's 15,000 people there waiting for him. I think we're going to see this as an indicator of where you need to go. And so you'll play, you know, I also think a lot of these, as the industry comes back, we probably will see them become geo-targeted so that you're playing specifically for a market and stuff like that. We're just so early in this medium that, like, it's just exciting to feel like every day I'm like, damn, we're working in the future.
Is there ever going to be like maybe some 3D or like some VR goggles you can throw on and then just be at a No Cap show? Is that something that's going to be in the
future? I wouldn't put it out of the question. I think VR is another one of those things that hasn't caught on. And part of the reason is because they haven't figured out how to make it so you don't get nauseous. Once they do that, it's game over. And I think porn will figure that out first, like it does everything online, right? But also you have to wear the gear, which is kind of like cumbersome so far.
I was wondering why Drake always is nauseous all the time.
Yeah, no, we'll try everything. I'm not going to say I know what the future holds. I'm not going to say I know the answer. I just know that this is like never going away. People are going to want to see this. We sell 60% of our tickets overseas. So those are already people who don't get to see these bands. And they're just like, fuck yeah. It's funny because I was talking to Donovan the other day and I had just got off the phone with someone who was like, nah, it's going to return to normal. Live streaming will not be it. Like, da, da, da. It's like some fucking agent who doesn't get it, right? And I'm like, okay, like he's smart. Maybe I should listen to what he's saying, try to figure it out. Then I'm on the phone with Donovan and his son's in the car and his son's like, you guys should get Young Thug. And I'm like, oh, aha moment. His son lives in Kauai and is not going to see a Young Thug concert.
Right.
Young Thug is not going to Kauai to play at the fucking
Veterans Hall or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so like that kid's opportunity to see Young Thug live is going to be virtually. And then also another thing I had recently is like several times is kids, I see them in the chat or after they hit us and they're like, I just saw my first concert. And their first concert was digital, right? And to them, it's no different. They don't have a history of like 25 years of live music to miss. You know what I mean? It's like kids who grew up with the iPhone. They don't know what it's like before the fucking iPhone. They don't care. They're just like, life has an iPhone, right? So like, we got to think about the kids and they're going to be fucking down with this shit.
Yeah, I mean, you think about how many kids are spending so much of their time gaming. I mean, gaming, living their life online, like
and
interacting
you,
online.
Push, you game too.
I know for a fact. Like, I'm there with
some kills and whatever. I see you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it only makes sense that they would be just as into like, oh, let me put my headphones on, turn out the lights, and just sink into a show.
Well, we have big TVs now. We have great sound systems. We have good headphones. We have the bandwidth to make sure the shows get to people. We also didn't have the infrastructure. So it's part of the reason it wasn't catching on before, because it was a bad experience. And now it's a good experience. And it's just exciting. I think in 18 months, we're going to see the first stars that were born of the streaming concert era. Oh. And they're going to be doing 20,000 people a night. And they're like, they grew their business on here. Like, everyone's thinking about how the this side is going to adapt. They're not realizing that this side is birthing new shit, you know? So you guys are smart. You're one of the first person I called, right? Like, I called you and I was like, I got this idea. And you instantly were like, I love it. Like, you got it very quickly. And for bands like you guys to adapt to it and start building your virtual audience and realize that it's going to be weird and interesting at first, but if you figure it out, it's going to be beneficial. And you're going to be able to play a show in Germany without going to fucking Germany.
I know. We're experimenting. Obviously, the last one we did, we experimenting with like different forms and pre-recording and doing it like a film or doing it this way. And it's just, we're just kind of figuring out different ways to do it and trying new things. You know what I mean? And I think part of that is just the discovery of a new, you know, a new kind of like, you know, medium basically. So it's for us, like, you know, we are a live band. That's what we do. That's when we tour a lot and we make our money as a touring band. And it's like, that's what people really love about Iration is, you know, yes, we make records and like people love the records, but they love the records because they like to come and hear them live. And so us getting together as a band, that's a huge part of it. And like you said, the biggest thing for me is like thinking about, this is not just something that ends when COVID ends. You know, it's something that you can touch people in markets where you just physically can't even get to. We have, you know, if you have fans in all over the globe or places you just can't.
Like, there's more fans in Brazil than anywhere, it seems, right? And we don't get to them ever. I also think it's a change in the system, right? YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, they all hoard our audiences. They don't let us get to our audiences. They don't give us access to them. They are selling advertisement and making money off of our audiences and our content. This is the dawn of monetizing your content as well, right? So the last one you did, which was a pre-recorded concert special, I would more put it akin to than a live stream concert.
Right.
It's still the debut of something no one's ever seen. They get to put it on while they're barbecuing in the backyard or whatever. And yeah, they're paying the artist for it. The artist is receiving that money, not fucking YouTube, who sold an advertisement for a fucking Viagra, like, to the fucking shit. Like, to me, it's a power shift similar to we've seen in every industry where, like, I always make it akin to, like, the NBA. The players took the power back, right? The players are like, nah, I'm going to make my team.
Yeah.
I'm going to go where I want. And I'm going to, because people are coming to see me. They're not coming to see the owner of the team. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I just think that's kind of a power shift moment, too, that, like, maybe we start debuting music videos on No Cap. Maybe we start debuting... Maybe a podcast like this visually lives on No Cap and you can charge people $1 a ticket and people are really, you know, valuing your output as a creator a little differently when they're like, damn, I'm supporting my creators rather than my data being sold at the cost of my creators.
Totally. Well, I love the idea. I think we all know that, like, you know, we're definitely going to be doing more streams.
It's just verticals of the shit, right? Whereas, like, I think that throws to the future model, which is you're playing, there's people at the show, but people can also tune in and experience that with you. That's like that's the whole fucking banana right there.
What about Cocoon? Are you going to be having any of your Cocoon artists doing some no-cap shows? And you want to talk a little bit about what Cocoon is?
Cocoon is an incubator, sort of the Y Combinator of music, I sort of liken it to, which is like, it's also really hard for emerging acts to break right now with all the noise, with all the cost of making content, the cost of recording, and being able to keep up with this. Like, I got to drop a single and a video every month, and I got to put out a bunch of auxiliary content and shit like that. So I just sort of made a place where brands, where the art of creating is subsidized and underwritten by brands that are sort of handpicked and curated, that makes sense organically to interact with these new artists who are brand new. These are artists you won't know their name yet. You hopefully know their name in 12 to 18 months. It's a beautiful creative space. It has three studios, and we let artists come and use the studios for free. We let people live stream there for free. We let we have a video team. We make music videos for people for free and do shit like that. So yeah, in a sense, it's also a digital venue, and we're going to do more live streams from there. And I'm trying to figure out the puzzle of how do we let emerging artists live stream without the cost being too heavy, but it's still being a premium experience. But yeah, Cocoon's awesome. Cocoon Malibu on IG, you'll find like some brand new artists that are handpicked for just being awesomely talented, and you won't have heard of them before. And if you want to find something new to fuck with, it's a great place to go and check it out. And it's awesome. Cocoon's just like, to me, it's like it's almost like a passion project just to give back to this emerging artist community. When I usually only get to work with one artist at a time to help develop, now I can help sort of develop a group of artists or a community of artists and give them a place to gather offline, meet each other, coagulate, and like help each other break. Every movement needs a scene, you know, like LA during the Mickey Ave, Swayze, yeah, Dirt stuff, yeah. Seattle during the grunge scene, New York during like the Strokes and that whole scene, you guys in Santa Barbara, Revolution, like there's a whole scene with everything, right? Yeah, and so Cocoon hopefully is like a physical space. When all these artists are stuck online, they still need to come offline and gather and gain momentum in strength in numbers.
Yeah, community, basically. You know, that's what it's all about now. It's communities. Cool, man. Well, thanks so much for doing this, dude.
I love it. That was awesome.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You know, I feel uplifted. Yay!
Thanks for listening to the Uplifter Podcast. This show is a Resonant Media production. It is produced and mixed by Drake Peterson and Christopher McCone. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And if you have some extra time, give this show a little bit of a rating. It really helps us out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
vacation for me. Time to live in the present. You know I always have the chance to be grateful and count my blessings. That's right. You know we only got one life. So bring on the good times. I'm thankful, no doubt. Start with the here and now.
Here right now. It is all I've got. We're riding on a feeling, but the feeling don't stop. Find your peace of mind when the mind runs clear. All I really know is what I'm doing right here. A new day is upon us, feel the rising sun. Have a little faith, put me in your trust. The words of the prophets here written on the wall. A new day is all.
Got me feeling nice. I'm only worried about right here, right now. Talking about